It's 6 minutes after 1 o'clock Central. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580, the Information Advantage. Celeste Quinn is away this week. I'm Tom Rogers. I lost count early of the number of names that journalist and author Dick Shapp drops in his autobiography named Flashing Before My Eyes, but that doesn't matter because in the end it's those experiences of the names that he drops that make the book so interesting. Shapp has had a lot of experiences in his long career, from his start in his teens as a sports reporter for a Long Island newspaper. He's collected a string of anecdotes that add up to a fascinating tenure as one of the nation's most recognizable sports broadcasters and authors. He's written or helped write more than 30 books, many of them other people's autobiographies. On television, you know him from ABC and from ESPN, where he hosts a weekly television show, The Sports Reporters, and a weekly radio program as well. Today, Dick Shapp joins us on the Afternoon Magazine, and we'd like you to be a part of the conversation. Join us today with your questions for Dick Shapp. The numbers to call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. And outside the immediate area, if you're calling long distance, you can call us for free, 1-800-222-9455. Once again, the local number, 333-WILL, out of town, 1-800-222-WILL. Dick Shapp, good afternoon.
How are you?
Very good. Thanks for joining us.
I apologize for all those drop names. my friend Gene Shalit, who went to the University of Illinois, has told people that it's very dangerous when he comes to my house. He has to walk carefully because I've dropped so many names. Some of them have shards, and he's afraid they'll cut him.
You swept up quite a bunch of them and put them in the first chapter of the book, which was very entertaining. What prompted you to go ahead and do your autobiography after doing so many others?
Well, I've wanted to do mine for quite a while, and 50 years in the business seemed like an appropriate time to stop and sort of take stock. Actually, more than take stock, it's to tell stories. But I think I will do it every 50 years from now on. It's fun to speak in your own voice after having spoken in several other voices. Of course, there are critics who would say that my voice is not the choice voice, but, you know, that's their problem. Working with myself, I found that I was very accessible and that I could reach me whenever I needed me. And I liked the questions that I was asked.
And you probably had to challenge yourself to pull out all of those anecdotes and stories,
I've been lucky. I mean, in two different ways. One is that while other people remember facts or dates or things like that, and others remember the detail of ball games, I remember anecdotes. For some reason, anecdotes stick in my head. The other way I've been lucky is that I've kept almost everything I've written back to my teens, so they were certainly a good guide. And also a good source for many of these stories.
What's it like going back to that time and finding the first things that you wrote?
Well, back to my teens, it's a little embarrassing. I mean, I was a king of cliches, as I expect most teenagers are. And when I read it now, I wince with almost every sentence. But the best thing to look back on was the decade of the 1960s. For me, that was the perfect decade to be a journalist. And I did the whole range of journalism in that decade. I started the decade as a senior editor of Newsweek. I went on to become city editor of the New York Herald Tribune, and I wrote, you know, like 7 or 8 books during that decade. And when the decade ended, I was co-host of the Joan Amath Show. So I had finally made it to television, I suppose. But also in that decade, I met Cassius Clay, who became Muhammad Ali. I met Lenny Bruce. I met Peter Falk. I met Joan Amath. I covered the Mississippi, the murder of the three civil rights workers in Mississippi. I covered the riots in Watts. I covered Mr. Nixon's presidential campaign in 1968. Covered Bobby Kennedy's senatorial campaign and John Lindsay's mayoral campaign. So, you know, there was nothing a journalist could want to do that I didn't have the opportunity to do in that decade.
Yeah, it sounds like back then things weren't so compartmentalized. You don't see sports reporters going out and covering news stories, or in many cases the other way around these days.
Well, you didn't see much of it then either, but I was always schizophrenic and always went back and forth. It started in college, and I began college wanting to be a sports writer and writing sports for the Cornell Daily Sun. And then in my junior year, I switched to the news side and became editor of the paper and began covering politics and things like that, and so I got hooked on balance, on not wanting to do the same thing all the time. And since I think it's basically the same journalistic skills that you bring to a story, whether it's about a baseball game or about a murder in someplace. It doesn't feel strange going back and forth. In fact, there are a lot of advantages to it. One being, like, the people in politics or show business, they love to ask me about the athletes, and the athletes like to ask about the people in other businesses. And so it's fun being split in half.
What keeps you coming back to sports, though? What is it about the field of sports?
Well, I thought I was out of it in the 1960s, and then a friend of mine who was a book publisher asked me if I knew a football player who could write a diary or keep a diary, and I recommended Jerry Kramer from the Green Bay Packers. Eventually, Jerry said to me, I'll do it if you'll work with me. So we worked together in 1967 on what became Instant Replay, which was at that time the best-selling sports book ever. And because of the success of it, almost every other publisher in existence asked me to do a sports book. I've always been very bad at saying no. So I actually agreed. I wrote 9 books in 16 months, which no one should do that. Maybe Simenon could do that with his mysteries, but
and this is obviously before the era of computers too. So
you
had technical
right.
Help either.
I can type faster on a typewriter than I can type on my word processor. So that didn't make a lot of difference. But they all wanted these books. I did all these books, and since then I've been back in sports a good part of the time. I mean, right now I review the theater for ABC, as well as covering sports for ESPN.
I like the note on the cover of the book saying that you may be the only one who votes for both the Heisman Trophy and the Tony Awards.
I think that's probably true. A couple of years ago, I hoped I was going to be able to vote for the same guy for both.
Is there a chance?
Name at the moment, but there was a running back at Northwestern who was a theater major. He was a candidate for the Heisman Trophy.
Darnell Autry.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He was also a theater major, and of course, Northwestern graduates have done very well in the theater.
Right.
So I was sort of hoping that he would win the Heisman and the Tony the same year.
How do you go about when you put together an autobiography? You mentioned that you asked Jerry Kramer to put together a diary. Is that how you do it for most people, or what? How do you get them to figure
people,
out?
I did diaries. Mm-hmm. With Jerry, the first book was a diary. With Dave DeBusschere of the New York Knicks, it was a diary. With a golfer named Frank Beard, it was a diary. With others, it's an autobiography. With Namath, that's sort of a weird thing to say you wrote somebody's autobiography. But I think most people understand what it is that they talk and I type. And so I did Joe Namath's, I did Joe Montana's, I did Billy Crystal's. And, I've always enjoyed getting inside other people's heads. One of the earliest as-told-to things I ever did was a magazine article with Rocky Graziano. And getting inside Rocky's head was really a bizarre experience.
In what way?
Well, Rocky talked like this most of the time. And one of the stories about about this fighter who goes to his manager and says, I'm ready now. I can fight anybody. I want to fight Rocky Graziano. And his manager looks at him and says, how many times do I have to tell you? You are Rocky Graziano.
So editing varies depending on which person you're doing the autobiography on.
Sure. Each one of these people has different strengths. Jerry Kramer is a natural storyteller, so it was pretty easy. Joe Namath, at the time we worked together, was a man who lived entirely in the present, and his method of communicating was mostly put-ons and put-downs, so that's what was emphasized in the book. Joe Montana was really difficult because Joe remembers almost nothing about his athletic career. He vaguely remembers that he once threw a fairly important pass to Dwight Clark.
Mm-hmm. So you have to draw it out of him.
You really have to. Then it becomes work. Bo Jackson, on the other hand, when I worked with Bo, he just really wanted to tell about his childhood, which was a very rough childhood. He stuttered as a child, and he was violent. He hit people and beat up people, and he wanted to talk about it, wanted to get out of his system.
And where is Bo Jackson now, by the way?
He lives not far from where you are. He lives just outside of Chicago. He works primarily for Health South, which runs physical rehabilitation facilities around the country. And he goes to junior high schools and lectures young people on staying in school, staying off drugs, staying out of gangs.
He's one of those names that just unfortunately disappeared over time.
Well, it was a meteor that flashed across the sky and then, not through any fault of his own, fell.
Right. with a hip injury, is that correct?
Yeah, yes, he had a displaced hip, and he ended up having the hip replaced. But it's funny, any other athlete I think whom I know would have been very either bitter or upset or angry about having their career terminated so quickly, so young. But I've never heard Bo express one word of bitterness or anything. He's always, you know, I figured that was it. He had a run as a professional athlete. Now he's a golfer and a hunter and a fisherman, and he's happy doing that.
How do you choose who do you write about? What distinguishes a personality that sparks your interest?
Well, again, it's different people for different things. When I worked with Jerry Kramer in Instant Replay, I chose him because he was privy to a great story, to the story of Vince Lombardi, the story of the Green Bay Packers, and he was a perfect person to do it because he was not a superstar and therefore would not, you know, draw too much attention. Yet at the same time, he was a good enough football player so that all his teammates and all his opponents respected him. And he was in the perfect position to be honest and to criticize other people, as long as he criticized himself just as harshly or even more harshly. And Jerry was great for that. With people like Montana or Namath or Henry Aaron, and obviously there you're choosing them because of their marquee value, and not necessarily because they're storytellers. It's because somebody wants to know what their life is like.
One of the most moving parts of the book, in fact, was how you came upon Tom Waddell.
Yeah, Tom Waddell was an Olympic athlete who finished sixth in the decathlon in Mexico City in 1968. And I didn't know anything about him. In fact, I didn't even know his name until in about 1987. I saw a little item in the New York Times saying that a former Olympic athlete was dying of AIDS. And immediately my reaction was, you know, this is a story I have to do. I mean, this is not only a story about an athlete, but it obviously extends far beyond that. AIDS is a plague of our times. And I started asking around and finally got an address for Tom and wrote to him and told him I'd love to write a book with him or about him. And he wrote back and said that he was committed at the time to working with another writer, and he was sorry because he respected my work and all of that. And so I wondered what I could do because the story was so compelling. So I went and did the story for 2020 at ABC. And in the course of the time while I was working on the story with Tom, he and his writer had a falling out. So I did end up doing the book. The story on 2020 aired several months before Tom died. The book, unfortunately, did not come out until several years after he died. But he was, you know, surely the most courageous athlete I ever met. I mean, when I met him, you know, he knew he had a death sentence, and yet he was as full of life as anyone I could imagine, and had as little fear as anyone I could imagine.
And you kept with him, stayed with him literally until the end, too.
Yes, my wife and I were sitting in his bedroom with a couple of his other friends when he took I think it was 36 pills and you know, went into a coma, which was his final coma. And before he became unconscious, he folded his hands across his chest and looked at us and said, "Well, this should be interesting."
Did you know what you were getting into when you began writing?
No, I really didn't. I had preconceptions. I had prejudices. I went out to San Francisco to meet Tom for the first time, and I was, you know, scared to death of whatever AIDS was, and afraid that if you shook hands you might catch it or whatever. And little by little, you know, I began to act halfway intelligently, and my preconceptions were sort of shattered the first night when Tom took me to a dinner of the Harvey Milk Gay and Lesbian Democratic Club, and the first guy I saw grabbed my arm and he said, "You know, when the hell are we going to get a hockey team out here?" So that didn't quite fit into my preconceptions. That night I met a man who had been one of the early Marlboro men in the ad, and I also met a cowboy who was in the Rodeo Hall of Fame, not your stereotypical homosexuals.
Mm-hmm. What kind of effect do you think the book had since then on the acceptance of gays in sports and maybe in life?
Well, I think I'd be overstating if I said it had a major effect. I mean, most people had their own preconceptions and their own prejudices, and I think I probably changed some, which is good. I mean, if I changed one or two, I'd be happy. When Tom died, I wrote an article about his life for Sports Illustrated, and they got many, many cancellations from angry readers who didn't want to read about a homosexual in the pages of Sports Illustrated. But at the same time, they got a lot of beautiful letters, too, and many of them from people who were not gay, who just, you know, understood what I was trying to say and understood what Tom was trying to say, and that was lovely.
Dick Schaap is our guest on the Afternoon Magazine this hour. You can join us with your questions or comments. The numbers to call, once again, in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. And outside of town, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. And you can also listen to us streamed on the Internet at will.uiuc.edu. Who do you look up to as, you know, you've had a lot of examples that you followed as far as writers go, as you go through your career. Who are your inspirations?
Well, as a kid, and even as a young journalist, Red Smith was sort of my ideal. I read him faithfully as a child. I eventually ended up working with him at the New York Herald Tribune, which is very exciting. I even sat next to him in a press box, my first story after I got out of graduate school. And that, too, was exciting, and I knew him right up until his death. And I also, when I was still very, very young, I met Norman Mailer, and Norman had been one of my heroes even before I met him, and still is, I think, in many ways, of the my generation or a slightly older generation, because he is older. I think he's the best all-around writer, pound for pound, that we have.
What makes being a good writer? What is it that you look for?
I think one of the things I look for is clarity, which may not always be Norman's strong suit, but I mean, he just dazzles you with his genius, with how much he knows about everything. And he's the only man who can put between parentheses a 300-word phrase that actually does tell you something and makes sense. But you know, I don't write that way, and I can't write that way, and then maybe that's why I respect it so much. On the other hand, a friend of mine, like Mitch Albom, who wrote Tuesdays with Maury, that is about as clear as a book can be, and I admire him very much.
And he wrote the foreword to your book, too.
Yes, he did, which means he's a good friend. Mm-hmm. And my friend Jimmy Breslin, who was my first boss when I was 15 years old, and has been my friend for 50 years, I mean, I think he is the quintessential journalist. He knows that you got to go out and look for the story. You got to talk to people. You got to listen to people. You got to hear things. You got to watch things. I mean, he's not a kid anymore, but he still does the work you're supposed to do.
I was tempted to start off the interview asking one thing that Jimmy Breslin would ask: "How you doing?"
Yeah, that's pretty much
just a very simple.
But, you know, it would work too, because then I would feel compelled to have to tell you something. I didn't want to bore you or bore your listeners.
What makes a good interview, or maybe a good interviewer?
Well, I mean, there are different kinds of interviewers. Some are successful by being confrontational. I am not. I try to be conversational. My feeling is I don't want to put somebody on guard. At the same time, I don't want them to just say to me what they think I want to hear. I want them to act like themselves. I want to relax and feel free to talk to me about anything. Now, obviously, that doesn't work to a total extent very often, but it works to a reasonable extent pretty often, and it's nice. I mean, generally, when I have a subject other than somebody I may just meet for one day, we actually get to know each other, and usually we remain friends.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that journalistically speaking, there aren't many differences between writing for sports and writing, you know, a general story. Do you tend to alter your writing style between the two genres, or is
no,
that pretty much the same
too? I really don't. I mean, the one thing I found, particularly in working on television, but also in print too, is that in writing or talking about sports, you could get away with a lot more political and sociological judgments than you can get away with if you're covering politics or sociology. I mean, you can make jokes about people, you can sneak into sports stuff, but if you tried to sneak into the news page, they'd get very upset. So I kind of like that. I remember, for instance, when Richard Nixon put the bombs in Haiphong Harbor, he called it Operation Linebacker. So later on, when he called Bob Greasy of the Miami Dolphins and suggested a play for the Miami Dolphins to use in the Super Bowl, you know, I equated the two, and this was Operation Quarterback, and You know, I was able to take some pretty good jabs and get away with it because I was talking about a football game.
And you mentioned in the book also that you just mentioned, in fact, that that you make friends with a lot of people that you do interview. You get to know them. Is there any worry about being, and in fact, that you mentioned that there's also no such word as objectivity in journalism, mm-hmm. strict objectivity. How do you ride that line?
Well, it's not easy, and I probably fall off it sometimes, but I don't know many people who don't. When I'm writing something which is judging someone who is a friend of mine, I generally include a disclaimer explaining that it is a friend. When I review the theater and I review a show written by a friend of mine, Neil Simon, for instance, I hated his last show, and I said I wished he hadn't written it, and I explained, you know, that he was a friend and I wished he hadn't written it, but still, I thought it was dreadful. And I've done that, you know, with other friends. But as you said, and as I said, you know, I don't believe there is such a thing as objectivity. I think everything you do as a writer or as a talker is subjective. I mean, just by the first word you use is a subjective choice, not an objective choice. I think the basic thing is to be honest, to have integrity, and to be credible. And I think I have a reputation for those two things, even though I might not have a reputation or want one for being totally objective.
Is it easier to write about people or things that you like or dislike?
When I was younger, I found it much easier to write about people that I disliked. Mm-hmm. I found it very easy and fun to be a sniper and to show how clever I was by sniping at people. For instance, I remember a newspaper column I wrote long ago when James T. Aubrey was fired as the president of CBS, and I wrote a story the next day which began, "The friends of James T. Aubrey gathered yesterday to complain about his firing, and both of them were very upset." And, you know, I thought that was quite funny at the time and quite amusing. As I went on, I found that I much preferred to write about people I liked. I didn't like to spend time with people whose company was not pleasurable. So I sort of, you know, in more recent years, I tend to write about the people I like and about the things I like.
Are there people who are more difficult difficult to interview? You mentioned those who don't say much are on that list, obviously.
Sure. I mean, of course, there are plenty of athletes who fall into that category. And there are plenty of politicians, too, uh-huh. who spout a lot of words but don't say much. It's equally frustrating in covering both of them. But at least the thing about the athletes that makes them interesting is that we have three sort of major groups of celebrities in this country: athletic celebrities, political celebrities, and show business celebrities. And of those three, the politicians and the entertainers, from very early stage in their careers, are taught to be on stage, to react to audiences. The athletes, on the other hand, from a very early stage, are taught to run and jump and throw and hit and stuff like that. And suddenly they're thrust onto a stage where they do have to react. And to watch the way they react becomes very interesting. Many athletes' careers are destroyed by factors that have nothing to do with their ability.
That they just don't know how to conduct an interview, perhaps.
Right. Not that, but that they just don't know how to react to pressure. Uh-huh. All the pressures that are brought to bear upon them, or how to react to all the temptations that become available to them.
Anybody that you've interviewed who's been intimidating at all? Who would you list among anybody that's been intimidating?
Well, I think most coaches try to be intimidating, uh-huh. because I think most coaches are by nature and by inclination paranoid. And they, you know, you say hello and they want to know what you mean by that. So I find that reaction intimidating. Jim Brown, I played against in college in lacrosse, and when he ran after me when I had the ball in my stick, he terrified me. I got rid of the ball as fast as I could. Even now, 40 years later, when I interview Jim Brown, he still terrifies me, but in a much nicer and friendlier way. Now, Ray Nitschke, the late linebacker for the Green Bay Packers, anytime I talked to Ray, he intimidated me. That was part of his act. Mike Ditka was the same way. Mike would scream and growl at you, and then once he showed you that he was the mean old bear, then he'd settle down and be a cuddly bear.
And somebody, of course, of Midwest interest is Bob Knight, who you mentioned in the book.
Yes, another.
And made in the news, I guess, very recently.
Right. I mean, Bob has never really been cuddly, but we were always friends. You know, I always knew that he was not unflawed. But at the same time, I respected him a lot because, A, I thought he was a great coach, but B, I thought he was what he was, that what you saw was what you got. He didn't pretend to be anyone else. This past year, some of his behavior has appeared aberrational to me, and not only when my son interviewed him, when my son did the first interview after he was fired, and Knight said to him about three quarters of the way through the interview, Jeremy, you've got a long way to go to be as good as your father, which was a real cheap shot. But not only with that remark, but with things afterwards, too, when he signed with a clothing company that also uses Latrell Sprewell to represent a company that, at least up to that point, sort of represented anti-discipline. And Knight had always been the pro-discipline person, it seems strange. And several of the things he's said and done since then seem, you know, out of character. Though some people will say nothing is out of character for Bob, but he can do the whole 360 degrees.
Have you heard from him since the interview?
No, I have not heard from him directly since the interview, but ESPN Classic is making a two-hour documentary version of my book, and they interviewed him the other day and told me that he had nothing but nice things to say about me, though he refused to talk about the interview with Jeremy.
Where do you think he'll go?
I don't know. I wish, I was one of the people who advised him not to go back to the University of Indiana once he was told that he could go back, and once they mentioned zero tolerance, I thought he should have quit then and gone fishing and hunting and playing golf. And I still hope that's what he does now. He's working on a book, and I admire his loyalty. He's doing it with his old friend, Bob Hamill. But I just worry what Bob is going to say in that book. He has a tendency, as many of us do, to be self-serving in his remarks. And if he does a self-serving book, a lot of people are not going to like it, but a lot of people are not going to buy it.
He's still got quite a following, though, too.
Yeah, so he does. And people who love him and people who hate him.
One other person that you spent quite a bit of time talking about, and you had the fortune of getting to know him back when he was a teenager, I believe, was Muhammad Ali.
Yes, I've known Muhammad since he was 18 years old. And I think today's his birthday. I think he's 59.
Oh, no kidding.
Today. And I love him as much at 59 as I did at 18. When he was 18 years old, the first day I met him, we were in a cab going up to Harlem, and he turned to me and told me that he was the greatest. And I'd never heard a grown-up say that, much less an 18-year-old. And he charmed me right from the beginning. When he was still 18, before he became a professional fighter, I went down to visit him in his hometown of Louisville, Kentucky. And one day we were driving down the main street, and I stopped at a traffic light, and there was a very pretty young woman standing on the corner who happened to be white. And I turned to young Cassius Clay, and I said, boy, she's pretty. And he grabbed my arm and said, you crazy, man? You can get electrocuted for that, a Jew looking at a white girl in Kentucky.
So sign of the age.
That he had the same kind of bizarre mind that I did.
Has he changed over time? I mean, aside from obviously physically.
He's changed more in people's perception of him, mm-hmm. than changing himself. I mean, he's more beloved now than he ever was. There were a lot of people who resented his stand on the Vietnam War, his refusal to serve in the armed forces, and I think many of those people have been converted or have forgiven him or have realized that it was not a great war to support in the first place. And so, I think when he stands up in the Olympic Stadium or he drops the ball in Times Square for New Year's Eve, there are still some people who don't like him, but they are a very, very small minority. Generally speaking, when I see him walk into a room, the room is just filled with love, that he exudes and with the love that people give back to him.
I take it he still thinks he's the greatest.
Oh, he still is the greatest. The last time I saw him was a couple of months ago. And I was emceeing a dinner at which he was being honored. And at the end, when he received an award, his wife, Lonnie, got up to make the acceptance speech, as she often does. And when she finished, Muhammad grabbed the microphone and said, my name is Muhammad Ali, for those of you who don't know. And as he said that, his right hand began to shake noticeably. And his wife took the microphone and said, he's exaggerating. Whereupon Ali leans to the microphone and said, don't tell him. I want him to feel sorry for me.
What a guy. This is, we're talking with Dick Shapp, and his book is called Flashing Before My Eyes, his autobiography. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Once again, we invite you to call in with questions or comments. Our numbers are 333-WILL in Champaign-Urbana. Outside the area, 1-800-222-WILL. You made the transition from newspaper or print journalism to television in mid-career. What kind of adjustment was that?
Well,
or was there?
There was more of an adjustment than I thought there would be. When I went into the television business, first I started as a co-host of the Joe Namath Show with Joe, and that you didn't have to know much for that because neither of us knew anything, and we winged it, and now they replay it on ESPN Classic, and it's so bad it's almost good.
I'd love to see that.
But the best show, the one you got to see, is the one where we had Truman Capote and Rocky Graziano on together as guests. And Capote was bragging about what a great athlete he was and how he used to beat Humphrey Bogart in arm wrestling. And after he talked for about a minute about how great an athlete he was, Graziano turned to him and said, "Didn't I fight you a six-rounder in Cleveland once?" And, of course, you know, Capote weighed about 3 pounds, and the wind would have knocked him over. That was a start. Then when I went into television on a regular basis, I worked for NBC's station in New York, and the first night I went on the air, the reviewer for the New York Daily News said he sounded like he wasn't going to get through it. Unfortunately, he did. So I think the criticism has been uphill since then.
There's a lot of criticism about the difference between journalistic styles in television and elsewhere. Is that the same in sports? Is there a difference in the style of journalism or the quality,
sure,
perhaps, in TV versus elsewhere?
Well, the main difference is that writing for television is very difficult to write well for television. The most important thing in writing for television is to be clear, to be simple. Now, that doesn't mean you can't write well, because you can write simply, clearly, and well, and excitingly, and vividly. But you have to pick your shots. You can't overwhelm a viewer with phrases. It's not like a book where he can stop and go back and say, "What did he say? What did he say?" Gene Shalit, who I mentioned before, is a good friend, and we worked together when I started at NBC. And he said to me, "You've got to tell them what you're going to say, then you say it, then you tell them what you've said." And there's a certain amount of merit to that. It's not a deep medium, television, but it is a very impactful medium.
And there's certainly room for good journalism.
Yes, and you know, there are good journalists who do it, and there are good writers who do it, but there are also a lot of people, you know, who can barely write their name and who, you know, don't have the slightest idea of what journalism is.
Who are some of the good guys?
Jim Wooten, who worked at ABC, you know, he was at the New York Times before that, is a really smart journalist. And was a smart newspaper man, and is a smart television man. I mean, he just comes immediately to mind. But there are others. I mean, I think I love to watch Sam Donaldson work, and not because of his writing skills, or not even necessarily because of journalistic skills, but his persistence as a reporter. I love his persistence.
Mm-hmm. Over time, you talk about how things have changed in covering sports and the ability of reporters to get two players. There's a question of access these days. Is it tougher now to cover sports in the way that you want, as far as getting to personalities these days compared to 30, 40 years ago?
It's much different, because when I started, there was sort of a semi-cooperative attitude between the media and the people we covered, in the sense that they needed us and we needed them, I mean, it wasn't that anybody was doing anybody a favor, but you know, that they wanted us to write about them, and we wanted to write about them. Now, the athletes don't really. It's an antagonistic atmosphere now. The athletes make so much money that it's very hard for the people who cover them to relate to them. They don't care about whether you write a story about them or not, as long as their latest slam dunk is on SportsCenter, and as long as their feet are seen in a sneaker commercial, that is sufficient for them to get their $100 million or $200 million contracts. There's also the racial factor, that most of the best athletes in the United States today are African Americans, or in the case of baseball, Latin Americans, and most of the people who cover them are not. And there's a sociological gap there that many of us, you know, try to span the gap, but it's not always easy, and we're not always successful.
If it's tougher to cover, why is it that sports is so popular these days when so many people are so critical of it, and people complain about the money and complain about the influence that money has on sports?
Well, it amazes me. but I think, you know, part of it is the added leisure time that people have. Part of it is the addiction to television. And so much of television is so predictable. The sitcoms and the dramcoms, you know, you often know, except for the very best ones, you know what's going to happen, you know who's going to say what, and when they say it, it isn't very interesting. Sporting events, generally speaking, you don't know how they're going to turn out. It's compelling. And I love working for a place like ESPN Classic, which shows only old stuff, and we don't show any bad games. I mean, if it's a bad game, we forget about it.
So no Seattle Pilots highlights on that. No Seattle Pilots highlights.
Yeah, we don't do that. But, you know, if you want to see Jim McMahon with the Bears, we do that.
Mm-hmm. Where do you see the trend going? I mean, is there going to be a backlash someday?
It's hard to say. I mean, obviously it all comes down to the consumer because he buys the products which spend the money to be on television, which gives the money to the network, to the leagues, which trickles down to the teams, and then they give it to the athletes. I mean, I've never met an owner who's an altruist. So even though they're spending huge sums, they're getting those sums from somewhere. I mean, you would think there would have to be a saturation point, but so far it doesn't seem to be in sight.
Although there are exceptions, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned coming back. You were talking earlier about how you covered the Green Bay Packers and it got kind of an affinity for them back in the '60s in their first Super Bowl appearances. And you came back 30 years later when the Packers came back to the Super Bowl.
Yeah, I mean, I have such a great affinity for the city and for the whole concept of a civically owned team. So I found myself very attracted to the 1996 team that went on to win the Super Bowl. But it was the guys from the 60s who I was really close to. I mean, they were my age. Bart Starr and Willie Davis and I were all born the same year. You know, Brett Favre, you know, obviously is young enough to be my son or maybe even my grandson. I mean, I like him. We get along fine. But we are of different ages, though most people, I'm sure, haven't noticed that.
What about things that are going on today or this year? What are the stories in sports that give you the most inspiration, that make you the most excited?
Last year was fascinating in the sense that the first truly big story of the year, well, it was an unbelievable story, the story of Kurt Warner. It was sort of like Damn Yankees. I mean, this guy appeared out of nowhere, whether he'd sold his soul to the devil or what. But he surfaced and you know, led his team to the Super Bowl championship. The last story of the year was equally dramatic, which was the return of Mario Lemieux, coming back from retirement, coming back from owning the team, going back on the ice and immediately establishing himself as, if not the best player still in hockey, certainly one of the two or three best, and you know, probably before the end of the season, everyone will agree that he is the best.
And it's still possible to do stories about those people.
Oh, yeah, and you know, Lance Armstrong in between winning the Tour de France again. Those are great stories.
Mm-hmm. In fact, I just today I saw a repeat of your parting shot that you had on your television show last week, and you mentioned that you were rooting for the Super Bowl for the Raiders and the Vikings.
Oh, I sure got that one right, didn't I?
Yeah. But you mentioned that there was a story involved with those two teams. Now what do you cover?
Well, no, they're still. I mean, this is Baltimore against New York. Mm-hmm. Baltimore and New York have played three times previously for the World Championship of Football, and two of those three games have been the two most significant football games ever played, or pro football games ever played. The first one was the 1958 sudden-death game between the Giants and the Colts, which the Colts won in overtime before a national television audience. It was a game that cemented the relationship between television and football and sort of sanctified the marriage. 11 years later in the Super Bowl, in Super Bowl III, the New York Jets with Joe Namath upset the heavily favored Baltimore Colts with John Unitas and validated the American Football League. Without the outcome of those two games or without the playing of those two games, pro football would have been infinitely weaker as it entered the 70s, which sort of began the golden era of pro football.
But of course, in this Super Bowl, it's not quite the Colts, obviously. It's a team that's moved from Cleveland, and when you could draw some parallels between the Packers, who have stayed in their city and have a very loyal following, compared to a team that's moved around. And does that sort of tell you something about sports?
Well, that does. But what also tells you is that in Green Bay, when I was out there in the 60s, and in Brooklyn, where I grew up, the local teams were our identity. The Packers for Green Bay, the Dodgers for Brooklyn. And every school child could tell you the starting lineup for the team. Every position, 22 players out in Green Bay, 9 players in Brooklyn. Every kid knew that. Now, even in Green Bay, they can't keep track of who's starting from year to year. The loyalty for a town and the loyalty toward players from the owners has just about vanished, and the dollar rules everything. And my rule of thumb is the higher the stakes, the fewer the laughs.
And now we have the entrepreneur and professional wrestling coming in and making a football league of his own. How will that fly?
Well, you know, I've watched professional wrestlers practice, and it's wonderful to watch them. They're very, very good athletes, and they put on a great show. It has nothing to do with sports, but it is a show, and that's what they're going to try to do in football, I presume.
Is there concern about the scripting of sports, though?
Well, I don't consider it a sport. I consider it a performance. And, I don't want to see sporting events scripted, and that's what they do in wrestling.
Speaking of performances, you mentioned early on that your career took another turn a few years ago when you started as a theater critic for ABC. What drew you to that?
Well, earlier in my career, when I worked for Newsweek, I edited the theater department, among other departments, and had some interest in it and learned a little bit about it by osmosis. And when the opportunity came up about 5 or 6 years ago to review the theater, I thought it would just bring some more balance into my life. And actually, given the choice, I would much rather go to see a show than go to a regular ball game.
What's the situation on Broadway these days? It's like sports, is not the same that it was.
Well, no. I mean, there's a great play that opened fairly recently called Proof with Mary Louise Parker, and it's magnificent. But I remember, again, 30 years ago, there would be 4 or 5 plays that would open like that. And this year, you would have an Arthur Miller play, you would have a Eugene O'Neill play. I mean, now you still have Arthur Miller and Eugene O'Neill plays, but now they're revivals of long-ago classics. And you don't get the kind of the number of new and good plays that you used to get. There's still, a Proof is a terrific play. And Copenhagen is a pretty damn good play, too. But it's not like it was because, again, people, just as newspapers are not the same because, young writers tend to want to go into television or something more glamorous than newspapers are today, people don't want to write for the stage, they want to write for the film.
But there's still a lot of creative energy there.
Oh, absolutely, and I love to see it. I mean, the wonderful actors really know that this is where they can ply their craft on the stage.
You said at the end of the book that you want to do pretty much the same thing you've done for the last 50 years. What's on your priority list from now on? What things have not been covered that you'd like to cover?
There isn't anything really. I just want to do more of the same and do it better. I'm sort of the advisor to this 2-hour documentary that's being done, and I just hope that will be as good as it can be. And then what I really want to do after that goes on the air at the end of February, then I want to go to sleep for a month.
That time-consuming. Huh?
I mean, between writing a book, promoting a book, and working on a documentary, there's a lot of lines in my face.
You also recently edited a book of some of the best sports journalism.
Right.
Is that going to be a recurring thing?
No, no. This is the 10th year of that. They've had a different editor each year.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I felt very honored to be following Richard Ford, who did it the year before. I mean, other John Feinstein has done it, George Plimpton has done it, David Halberstam has done it. And it was a good experience for me because it forced me to read a lot of articles that I otherwise would not have read, and I was impressed by the quality of the articles and by the quality of the writers.
And ESPN is still in the picture, too.
Oh, yes. They're going to keep me off the streets.
All right. Dick Schaap has been our guest this afternoon on the Afternoon Magazine. His autobiography is called Flashing Before My Eyes, and we thank you for joining us this afternoon. It's been very interesting.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.